This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. This month, we are sharing conversations with you about the long road to Moccasin Bend as it is today and its future. Here in Chattanooga, Forever Moccasin Bend is the fundraising campaign to build parking and new visitor amenities at the gateway site of the Moccasin Bend National Archaeological District. Former Congressman Zach Womp led the effort in Washington to create the district. He worked with elected officials, Native American leaders, and local citizens for 8 years, until 2003, when Congress passed and President George W. Bush signed the legislation that protected the Bend with national park status and placed it under federal ownership. I spoke with former Congressman Womp and with Tricia Mims, Executive Director of National Park Partners. Congressman, Tricia, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Congressman, tell us more about the first time that you encountered Moccasin Bend and it just took your breath away and its significance.
Well, I thought about this a lot in advance of this interview because it's been a long time ago, you know, and the older you get, the harder it is to remember a long time ago. But Tricia said you wanted some of the nuances of how this all started. But as you know, the effort started about the time I was born. In 1957, the 1950s is when the effort started. And then when I was made aware of it, I had the privilege of running once and losing in 1992 and then winning in 1994. So that gave me 4 years of preparation before I got elected on a lot of issues that I learned about as a candidate. I always tell people that your second time candidates make better incumbents because it gives you a longer time to figure out what things are and what needs you should focus on. And the Friends of Moccasin Bend at the time had been around a long time and gone through several gyrations, almost generationally. I came out of a family where my late father was a prominent architect, and he had worked with Mrs. Z. Carter Patton of the Historical Society on a bunch of land use issues in downtown Chattanooga. And so I had this kind of connection to some of this anyway, kind of a predisposition to all things conservation was sort of in my DNA, I think, frankly, from the upbringing. So then when I was made aware of this history, I was really attracted to it because selfishly, any new elected official thinks in their mind about what can I do to leave a legacy? And I mean, that's honestly a selfish motivation, but it's also a good thing because you really want to leave something of impact. And there was nothing that I saw of the impact locally at that time that mirrored Moccasin Bend because it's a 12,000-year legacy that I could actually carry forward potentially. And so I knew that there had been frustrations of start, stop, economic development. Mayors had looked at the whole bend to build stuff on. You'd been through all these different, and plus you had investments out there that were non-conforming, like a mental health center was built there, I think by Governor Clement, because he wanted to put patients out at the end of a place where they couldn't escape or whatever, which is not a good motive, but that is probably what happened. And then a golf course was built, and then there's a firing range. And so it was a challenge that had a lot of political complexities, but I kind of took it as a challenge. You know, what can we do here? And then I had the unique privilege in my first term of working on trying to get on the House Appropriations Committee. And you normally can't do that in your first term, but I did it in my second term. Actually, Congressman Fleischman did the same thing. You work for a term to get on it. I got on it, and then I got to choose my subcommittees. And one of the choices I had, because we were in the majority, was the Interior Appropriations Subcommittee. Well, the Interior Subcommittee, very influential on all land use things, including the National Park Service, which comes under us for all of their funding that's not mandatory. And so I learned a whole lot. In the 5 years I was on the Interior Appropriations Subcommittee, I'm thinking the whole time about what does it take to get Moccasin Bend added to the national park system. And in my mind, I'm thinking early, let's do it through an appropriations bill. And then I realized you can't do that because the committees of jurisdiction, like the House Resources Committee, completely going to reject the appropriators having the power to add some to the national park system. Then I realized that all the studies have to be done, and that's very, very complex, and that's good. Because you can't just slam dunk a political motive on top of an, you know, institutions, which basically for 100 years, you know, since Teddy Roosevelt, we've been actually developing processes through the national park system to add land that was historically significant. And we had to make that case that this was significant in every way. And so I'm figuring all this out while I'm working with the Friends of Moxon Bend to try to determine what's possible. And then I'm figuring out the landmines associated with the hospital, the golf course. You know, I'm hearing from those people and the, you know, law enforcement on the firing range and all these, not in my backyard, don't come tell us what to do, blah, 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 blah. And so you try to build consensus around the possible. That's what they said politics was, is the art of the possible. So here I'm sort of trying to figure this out like a real estate deal. You know, how do you keep everybody going in the same direction and get to the closing table? And through that learning process, I figured I'm going to have to offer a bill, which we wrote. A guy named Dr. Dwayne King was one of the, he was one of my sharp knives in my toolkit because he was a guy from New Mexico. He knew everything about the Trail of Tears, all of the Native American history, the significance of this land. He had become a subject matter expert. So the Friends were giving me the education that I needed as a lawmaker to go argue this case in Washington. And so I wrote the legislation on the House side, starting at the subcommittee of the Resources Committee. And I go and I present it at a hearing of the subcommittee. I get it approved. Then I have to go back and do the whole same thing at the hearing of the full committee, get it approved. They send it to the House floor. At the same time, talking to the Senate to make sure there are not going to be objections over there if we get it through the House. And then I get the leadership of the House to put it on the suspension calendar, which is the non-controversial calendar, as long as you don't expect major objection. And I knew that I had some objections because it added obligation. It, you know, one thing I learned at the Interior Appropriations Subcommittee is we had this huge backlog at the National Park System of needs, infrastructure needs, maintenance needs. It's the reason Lamar Alexander just pushed so hard for the Great American Outdoor Act, because that's a way to get caught up on the maintenance needs. And the only way you can add new assets is if you get caught up on your old assets. And we implemented, while I was at the Interior Appropriations Subcommittee, what's called the Fee Demonstration Program, which was the ability for the Park Service to collect funds at that site to be used for maintenance at that site for certain park features, including, frankly, Point Park. You know, in the Chickamauga Chattanooga National Military Park, they actually have fee demonstration up there, which was part of what we did. I was literally on the committee that did that. Ralph Regula was our chairman. We initiated that. Lamar did great work now on this latest one, but you can't add new things unless you're paying for the old thing. So I had to figure that puzzle out, but it was a great challenge and we succeeded. And then it didn't hurt at all since we were in the majority when my friend Bush 43, President Bush, got elected and named Fran Minella as the National Park Director, because I basically had allies there on the Republican side. You know, typically, historically, Democrats are land use people and Republicans aren't so much. Lamar and I were different as Republicans and had that. But I actually had friends in the Bush administration that were pro conservation, preservation advocates like Fran Minella. And she literally was at Point Park with us to have the signing ceremony of the legislation. And so that's really the process of 1995 to 2003, I think it was, Tricia, that it took us that long. Part of my early service was learning how to do it. And then it was going to do it. And then it was a process. It takes time. I mean, when the Park Service says it's going to take us 18 to 24 months to do the studies before you can even present it to the subcommittee, you know, I mean, that's like hurry up and wait. You know, you really want to get it done, but you can't go until you have these things documented. There's no way they're going to approve it. The staff director is going to say, no, if you haven't cleared this through the historical significance, the economic development benefits, all the studies that they run. And so you wonder, why does it take that long? But I see all that now in retrospect as just the process through which we have good governance in this country. It's never perfect, but it's still better than anywhere in the world. So that's a little snapshot of it, thinking back from the best of my recollection.
One of the tools in the toolkit you have been talking about the past few minutes was the designation as an archaeological district. Where did that come from, and how did that play into the result we see today?
Yeah, really good question, because at one time I wanted this to be a separate unit of the national park system. And I realized there's no way that's going to happen. Not in this climate, not at this moment, not with this big backlog. You're not going to get that. I can't remember the number, but it's like 400 different units in the national park system. You're not going to add another one. However, you could potentially add it as a subunit of the Chickamauga-Chattanooga National Military Park if you have a uniqueness about it that warrants it other than just a land acquisition. And that uniqueness, Ray, is the archaeological district. There's not another one like it in America. Nowhere else in the national park system is there an archaeological district. Because if you think about it, our country's, 240-something years old. Archaeology is not 240-something years old. It's more like 12,000 years old. And so that was the unique aspect of this. Unlike any other, you can't go to the Grand Canyon National Park and find some 12,000-year history of human activity underneath that that would warrant an archaeological site. We had that unique quality that gave us that difference. It was a discriminator. It was something that all of a sudden said, people said, wow. And then you start talking about the paleo era, and you talk about DeSoto and the Spanish era coming through there, and all of a sudden you've got everybody's imagination. I had a lot of fun going to these committees making the case, because people thinking, not only is that an amazing story, but all of a sudden they're thinking I'm smart, and that's not true, but it was fun, you know, because it really was something. The friends gave me the juice to go and get something big done.
And what did you learn from consulting indigenous tribes along the way, especially once you hit on the designation as an archaeological district? Because that's a whole nother thread of sensitivity, talking to people from an indigenous background and talking about land use.
Yeah, so you almost have to have people of goodwill in each one of the five civilized tribes willing to sit down at the table with you. Because just like with anything, other organization building, Ray, there's competition. There's always, what are you up to? You know, are you trying to game one of us? People were literally thinking that we were somehow wanting to establish some casino zone, you know, that we're going to come bring in casinos like Oklahoma. So, again, it was like threading the needle. But when we brought in the Duane Kings of the world that had built the kind of trust with the indigenous tribes over a long period of time, you're not going to refute that. And so we literally had the Eastern Band and the Cherokee Nation and all of the five tribes join to say, yes, yes, yes. In fact, I think Tricia knows this, but the whole second half of my 16-year service, there was only one member of the Congress of the House that had a Native American flag at the door of their office, and it was me. I had the Cherokee Nation flag with the American flag and the Tennessee flag, and of course, Ben Nighthorse Campbell also had a flag in the Senate at the same time, and we became friends. We didn't know each other. We became friends over Moxon Bend because of the unity among the indigenous tribes about protecting special places and special people, special history. So that really brought us together. That was what potentially could have been a divisive thing, became a unifying effort around what's now called the Moxon Bend National Archaeological District.
And there must have been so many points along the way where it seemed like it was just about going to fall apart and not be able to be put back together again. Do some of those moments come back to mind now?
Well, yeah, but I had the benefit of looking back at the Friends activity from 1954 or whatever, thinking, look how many times what they thought might happen fell apart. So I'm thinking, I'm much closer, like if this was a football game, I'm in the red zone, and they were still persevering when they were on the other side of the field. I mean, think about that. So I'm literally looking the whole time thinking, they've brought us inside the red zone. All I got to do is get us across the finish line or across the goal line. So I really wasn't discouraged, but it is. It's complex in a good way. It's actually a really great civics lesson. You know, if you taught a bunch of, say, sixth graders about Moccasin Bend, And this may be an interpretive type thing, Tricia, when we get fully implemented out there on the bend, to talk through how laws are made, how a unique asset is added forever. We should say that word, shouldn't we, Tricia?
Forever.
How do you add something forever to the national park system? This is amazing. I don't know what our country's going to look like in 200 years, but I believe we'll still be here. And I believe Moccasin Bend National Archaeological District will still be here. It'll just be much more robust and visited, and it'll be a great educational experience, and it'll just be a little stake in the ground that we were able collectively to add for who we are, where we came from, what are we about, why is the United States of America such a unique place, and what role did this unique place where the plains and the river and the mountain meet. That's where humans have gravitated for 12,000 years, for millennia. And, you know, Ray, that's what captured my imagination. When you bring in the experts and they say humans gravitate naturally to where the river and the plains and the mountains meet, and that is Moccasin Bend. That's actually Hampton Place, right?
Mm-hmm. Giving me chills, Congressman.
And Tricia, Moccasin Bend is all of these things that the Congressman has been talking about, and it's about something else, perseverance.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it really is a story of human triumph over obstacles. And if you think about the same piece of land being a source of desperation and despair, you know, with the Trail of Tears coming through there after millennia, as the congressman says, of people inhabiting and enjoying that land as their ancestral home, to be forced off it right there at the bend. And then 25 years later, the U.S. Army supply line, it was this source of rejuvenation for the Civil War troops, the U.S. Army troops that were starving in the town of Chattanooga. And without that supply line being reopened along that same Trail of Tears route, the Civil War outcome might have been very different. So there's just so many complex stories, but at the end of the day, it really is about overcoming the obstacles to preserving the land, overcoming the legacy, the mixed stories, good and bad, that are embedded in the land. And I think it's just something that everyone, no matter what your background is, that there's a story at Moccasin Bend that you can relate to.
And how will the Gateway site propel the storytelling at Moccasin Bend forward, not only into the near present, but for generations to come?
Well, it provides a welcoming entrance to that befits the nation's only National Archaeological District. You know, when you arrive at a national park, you just expect to see, you know, a certain entrance, somewhere to park, somewhere to stretch your legs, maybe immediately access the property, get oriented to where the trails are. And Moccasin Bend has really been lacking that since the preservation. It's just, as the congressman said, sometimes these things take a long time of, okay, where are we going to put these amenities in a place that's not going to disrupt anything that's culturally sensitive? And of course, everything costs money. And how do you build something that you're then going to have to maintain? So all of those pieces had to line up in place, but now we're finally here at this moment where the Park Service is ready. They've developed the long-term vision. We're 95% almost of the way funded for this project, and we're just a little bit more to go. And then we'll have that. We'll have those abilities for people to immediately access the property when they arrive, find out where the trails are, maybe enjoy an interpretive program about how legislation is crafted, and like the legislation that made Moccasin Bend possible at the site. So we're really looking forward to really being able to sort of open that access up in a way that engages and draws people in to learn more.
Congressman, I asked this question of Mickey Robbins when I spoke with him and Tricia for Scenic Roots. I'll ask you, when you think of Moccasin Bend, favorite spots for you?
Well, I think when you go down really at the Johnson Mental Health part of the Moccasin Bend Mental Health Center, and you're at the river and you're looking up at Point Park at the mountain, it is so majestic. I understand why historically humans gravitate towards there. That's my favorite place. And Hampton is off to your right, where there's such rich history buried however many feet under the ground. But I'll tell you another thing, Ray. This year, 2020, is such a weird year. 2 months ago, an animal reminded us how awesome Moccasin Bend is. A bear came into Walhatchie, into Lookout Valley, on a Saturday morning and swam the Tennessee River, crossed Moccasin Bend, swam the river again, and ended up going downtown Chattanooga. I actually tweeted that if there is reincarnation, I want to come back as that bear. But that bear reminded me what all has happened at Moccasin Bend. Imagine that. A wild animal, a big bear, swims the river. You know, and that's not 100 years ago. That was 2 months ago. And then you think, like you say, of the Trail of Tears crossing right there. And that's the part that's already interpreted. That trail is there. You can see across to Browns Ferry Landing. Our partnership has actually allowed for more land to be acquired to set that aside. The tavern on the other side in Tiftonia, Wauhatchie, Lookout Valley has been protected. So it is this collection of things, Moccasin Bend, and it goes so far back. It's such a unique place. I hope I live to see the non-conforming uses, at least most of them, go away so that this roughly 1,000-acre tract can be more like it was years ago. But most of it is, and I still think it's going to provide that kind of gathering place with a depth to it where people will literally feel a connection to history like no other place. When you go to Chickamauga Chattanooga National Military Park, you feel a connection all the way to the Civil War, but you don't feel a connection to that land all the way back to the year 1200 or before Christ. At Moccasin Bend, I mean, I literally, and I may just be this kind of person, but when I get in those zones, I feel connected to history millennia ago. That's the unique part here. This is not a 200-year history. This is 12,000 years of history documented in one place. That's an American special place. As we can kind of expose that to the country and to the next generation, I think it will really become more special by the day.
And Tricia, I asked you last time about your favorite spot, and now I'm asking you, after the congressman talking about the bear and millennia, it's quite a tall order to ask, but any other spots out there that have been on your mind lately as the Forever Moccasin Bend campaign has been moving forward?
Not too far from where the congressman is talking about on the Blue Blazes Trail, if you've ever hiked there. It starts at Moccasin Bend Road and kind of makes a little loop out to the river and back. But as you walk out, you're kind of at the edge of the Stringer's Ridge. So you see those ridges and mountains. You get out there at the point of the trail where you're steering up at Point Park and right there at the river's edge. And then as you're coming back, you're kind of at the top of a levee. And down below is where the Hampton Village was. So you really get the feel for all of it. You know, you think about the Civil War soldiers camped up on the ridge there, and the earthworks where the cannon were is just right there nearby where you are. And then you get out there at the river and you can imagine them fishing, and just that was a focal point. And then on your way back, you look down and think there was a village here hundreds of years ago. It's just fascinating to think about all of the different uses of Moccasin Bend and people who have...
One other story, Ray. I don't want to lose this, but this was a connection point for me. On the floor of the rotunda of our nation's capital, there are 8 permanent paintings on the floor, 4 on each side. One of those is the Hernando de Soto exploration, crossing the Mississippi River and being greeted there by the Native Americans. And they're doing quite a few things. They're planting flags in the ground. There's a crucifix going in the ground. And I think Bermidi painted that painting. But every time I was in there giving a tour or talking to young people, I'm also thinking and sometimes talking about that same group, that same exploration coming across the country on their way to discover the Mississippi River. And where were they, Tricia?
Moccasin Bend.
They stopped here. That's the beauty of Moccasin Bend. That's American history pre-America. That's part of this. Wow, how rich is that?
And if people want more information about Forever Moccasin Bend, if they want to help, where can they go online? Where can they call?
Well, they can go to forevermoccasinbend.org. That's our campaign page that shows the plans for the Gateway site and ways that you can get involved. And our phone number here at the National Park Partners is 423-648-5623.
All right. Congressman Tricia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Today, the second half of my conversation with the guitarist and inventor Kaki King. We left off last time talking about the impact of the pandemic on life in New York City this past spring. And that's what we'll pick it up again.
It's been a reckoning for sure, but at the same time, I mean, my God, I think what's not being talked about often is that the reason we're not doing shows is because people are dying. The reason why we have live streams is because you know, we'd like to keep our jobs and to, you know, connect with each other. But it seemed very, very, to me, inappropriate when people just rushed to everything being online and the self-righteousness that came along with that. And I understand the financial implications more than anyone because, you know, I've got two children and that there's nothing like that to make you feel like you're inadequate and there's no amount of money that you could have that's going to protect these little things. But I still think it's really difficult to get excited about doing a show in any for any reason when we're in the middle of so much, we're surrounded by so much illness and so much death. And so I even question my own motives in doing the Georgia Tech live stream and putting out an album and in all of these things. It seems it's very hard for me to raise my hand and say, pay attention over here, over here. I know there's a lot of hospitals that are full right now, but I play guitar really well. I mean, it's crazy. And I don't know how to balance that with, plus, you know, I need to make an income and I have merch items to sell. I mean, I don't know what to do. But I think about all those things every time I make a move.
Yeah, and it seems to me that at least in part is the thinking behind the record, right? The music that you made. It's a response to this moment.
Interestingly, much of the music was written prior to the pandemic. Some of the titles had not. So the framework, the time frame of making the album was March 2nd to March 18th. March 2nd was, there were some cases. Things were getting a little bit, you know, there were more than rumors and whispers. It was clearly something, but, you know, I played a massive party on that weekend. And, you know, the next week, school was closed. And New York City was in full lockdown. I mean, the timeline of making this album was very short, but it was the timeline that COVID came to the United States and was hitting New York especially. And we all got it. Everyone in the studio, we ended up passing it around to each other. Unbeknownst to us, because there was no way to, you know, we probably already had it for a week. And anyway, so yes, there are some song titles that are very specific to the pandemic moment because of exactly when that album was being mixed and mastered. And we're talking March 18th, 19th, 20th. It's sort of at the, you know, the beginning of the beginning, or the middle of the beginning, I suppose, especially in New York.
Yes, I kept thinking, yeah, to have been in New York City at that point. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, I can't think of a parallel. I suppose a bit like being hit by a tornado. All of a sudden, everything that you've taken for granted can't be taken for granted anymore. Everything has been called into question and threatened.
Well, yes, but keep in mind, and this is the crazy part, is that it was supposed to be for 2 weeks.
Mm.
You know, I mean, that was not what people were telling us, but that was simply the, you know, kind of what we were going on, is that, you know, it was always a wait and see, but we just, you know, 2 weeks, a month, and then we had no idea. I mean, and people were like, a month? How will I ever survive? And little did we know. So, yes, that initial time frame was really hard, but it was nothing compared to what, you know, would eventually become our reality. And so even at the time, I thought, this is ridiculous. I can't name these songs, these titles. And even though they had been mastered, I thought, well, you know, nothing's gone to print yet. I can always change them. And so Sanitized Alone, Final State, Can't Touch This or That or You or My Face, you know, these are very obvious references to the pandemic, but they weren't even meant to be as permanent as they obviously now are.
Thank you. This is Scenic Roots. My guest is the guitarist, writer, and inventor, Kaki King, who has spent much of her life looking for ways to incorporate technology into her performances, both in the studio and in front of an audience. The inventor and futurist Ray Kurzweil, a man responsible as much as anyone for inventing machines that make music, predicts that by 2045, machines and humans will merge, redefining life as we know it. Listening to Kaki King on record and watching one of her virtual shows staged at Georgia Tech recently is perhaps a glimpse of the future as Kurzweil sees it. About you as a performer, as a player, is to go back to that idea that that sort of Georgia Tech approach is an ideal for you, because there's so much tech involved in what you do, but then at the same time you're an improviser, so it's you know, and so very much in the moment, and every time you perform something it's different. When you introduce that level of tech, did that complicate your playing as an improviser, or not?
Not if you build it into the tech. So with all the performances that I do that have a major video component or a major, you know, triggering component, I mean, everything is built so that it can feel live. And that's really the trickiest part, because it's much easier to build a robust technical setup, you know, that is almost on as if it was hardwired, as if it's like a, you know, we replicate every time and we get the exact same output and we just, you know, pack it up and move it to the next place and then we do the same thing. And I don't want to do that. So with every performance, with every song, whatever it is, there is enough liveness, be that from my video operator performing with me, be that from myself triggering what you're looking at, from a variety of different ways, that, you know, this train could derail at any moment. And I think that people can sense that. It may not be absolutely obvious of who's pushing the button. You know, is it my guitar? Is it a video op backstage? You know, that's not really the point. The point is that it feels live and it feels in the moment. And maybe it's a few milliseconds off, and so it just, you know, you've got this sense that there's a human behind it all, and that is the goal. So yes, while I've introduced a lot of technology into my performance and playing in recent years, it still has this feeling of, you know, it's very human.
Congratulations on figuring out how to do that, because
I don't claim to be an expert. I'm only trying. I mean, it's only an attempt, right? But I think it's more about the philosophy and you know, keeping that as the goal rather than saying, well, I've perfected it, moving on, because, you know, there's nothing that'll kill you sooner than telling someone that you figured it all out.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah, I don't know. I know it. Yeah. You know, feeling, you know, feeling, technique in the service of feeling, feeling. That's the hard part. That's the hard part to get across. You know, that's the hard part to connect with somebody. And you know, and but you manage that, and that's really hard. You know, tech has been so much a part of the music, particularly in the last, you know, 30, 40 years. And the problem with it, a lot of it is, you know, that they have a hard time with the feeling part. The tech part's great, you know, and all this whiz-bang stuff, you know.
There's always been a lot of crap. And, you know, every musical genre, it's mostly terrible, and there's a couple of good things, and then, you know, that influences something else, and it morphs into its own thing. I mean, I truly believe that it's not, that nothing has changed. That's what I believe. That it is really, really difficult to write music that touches people and that people love, and that are, you know, what we call would turn into classics. And, you know, the classics survive because that's all we have. Everything else dies some sort of death and then is resurrected as, you know, unheard or unknown. And it's maybe there was a good reason for that, and it just to our new ears sounds kitschy or funny or whatever. But no, there's always been bad music. Trust me.
Agreed.
Technology did not change that force in any, and probably made it much better.
I think the problem is that art is antithetical to business in some ways. Art is very much about the moment, whereas business wants something that's stable. You know, I think that's the challenge for any artist, is to create art that also draws an audience.
It's a age-old dilemma where, again, and, you know, acting like it's, you know, like all art that's been sold is a sellout, and all, you know, art that no one ever has heard of is pure. I mean, this you know, I just don't buy into it. I think that advertising can be powerful. I think that you know, someone's underground record, it's not just, you know, personal. It's maybe personal to them, but it also can be quite terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't really know. I've never had any clue as to who or what I'm trying to please. I live exclusively in an incredibly obscure, weird guitar world, even that I personally don't fit into much at all. And so I've never had this personal pressure on me to, like, go out and sell it. You know, I have a humble career. I'm very fortunate and lucky for it. I keep getting to explore new things, and it's fabulous. But I have had a lot of friends who over the years have suffered under the, you know, you need to sell your music and also sell yourself, and you need to look good while doing it. And it is, trust me, that is a life that I would never want.
Thank you. you've cracked it. And very few people, can, you know, very few people can. And I don't, and I don't certainly want to tell you that, you know, you're done, you know, but that's cool.
You know? You know what people say the most about me? They're like, I can't believe more people aren't here tonight. I can't believe more people haven't heard of you. And I'm like, don't you think there's a reason for that? I'm like, all over the internet, come find me. Hello, I'm not hard to find. And I think there's hundreds and hundreds of artists at my level that have the same thing. And I think that there's a, you know, there is only a limited amount of people in this world who are going to like the thing that I do. And I am perfectly fine with that. I think that applies to a lot of others. And I don't think I've cracked anything. I think I've merely been too, without trying to, I'm just too weird. I have in my whole life. This predates my career. I was just, I didn't fit in and I didn't care to or know how to. And even if I you know, it was just, you know, I was like a, you know, everyone else in the turn of the last century was just, you know, wandering around and you know, investing in businesses and doing what they could. And the philosophers were scratching their heads like, wow, how does any of this exist? How is this work in front of me real? I don't understand. You know, I just don't get it. And so that's kind of been my thing. Like I've been my own worst enemy in that way, and yet it has saved me from having to, you know, swim along with everyone else.
Yeah, and I guess,
and not to mention the fact that no one in their right mind would ever. Well, nowadays it's a little bit different, but 20 years ago, no one who had any kind of ambition would go out and say, I want to play solo acoustic guitar for the rest of my life. Like, that's crazy talk. And I didn't have that either. I just was doing it because I liked it and it was fun. And it did happen to turn into this amazing career. But not by, I think, despite myself rather than because of it.
Yeah, and I really admire that in a person who just follows their own star. Doesn't, I mean, obviously, you know, you're a responsible person. You've got children. You're not kind of out there just saying, I don't care. But on an artistic level, you are. You're doing what feels right to you. And
yes,
when you do that, there's going to be people listen to you and there's going to be people that enjoy it, I think. Always.
Keep in mind that so much of that often is not up to me or up to the artist. Is a very weird combination in my example with, you know, knowing what the guitar can do, wanting to do more, the guitar saying, no, we're going this direction, and this push and pull between the artist and the instrument, and sometimes the song doesn't come for months, and sometimes it writes itself in 5 minutes, and I do not have the equation. I don't have, I cannot write a song better or faster now than I could when I was 19. It's not up to me.
I know, it's such a, life is an eternal paradox, is it not?
If
that wasn't evident before, it's, I think it's evident now.
Yeah, sure is.
Looking at the internet, it appears that you're going to be playing shows live next year. Is that the plan?
I mean, these algorithmic artifacts, yes, are, there was a European tour planned. I mean, I think we were talking about it pre-pandemic. And I think we confirmed the dates before it was known. I mean, who knows? Though I will try to scrub those out. I know they're still probably on my Facebook, but they are, they have been reconfirmed for the fall. But even I am not at this point saying anything because I would love to be able to go and play shows. I don't want anyone ever to be harmed because of something that I'm doing. So whatever happens, it will be with incredible caution that I would proceed. I would be shocked, but I would also be thrilled. I would be thrilled to go to New Jersey today. So, you know, times have changed.
What's your response to that kind of not knowing as a performer? To go back to that question again? Do you intend to do more virtual shows or not?
I don't know. I think there are opportunities where there's a little more. There's a little more production value. I don't know. I mean, I think that what I'd probably like to do is shift my talent to teaching in order to get to weather this financially. I mean, sure, if someone's willing to support a virtual show from me, 100%. And it doesn't cost me a thing to just, you know, turn on my phone and make a virtual tip jar. But again, it's this feeling of like, why am I doing this? What purpose am I serving? Am I, you know, is this fun for me? Is this fun for you? Is this, you know, I was watching the, Questlove. He's been doing these great DJ sets. He does them almost every night, and he's getting out the vote in Georgia. And, like, you know, it's a party. But I have seen that guy DJ for thousands of people. He's a musical. You know, this brilliant musical mind who knows everything about everything. And he's like just like any other person, like struggling with the tech and trying to make it look better than it is. I mean, you know, and oh man, but you know, it's the human spirit to try, right? The human spirit to get creative and do things. My answers to all these questions would be so different if I didn't have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old. And, you know, even when they're not taking up physical space, they take up a lot of mental space.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that probably my, it's, you know, I'm doing a better thing when I spend time with them and, you know, we just got new bicycles for everyone and things like that. And I do think in the new year, I am going to start teaching again, and hopefully we'll, you know, be able to really, like, I feel like if I could help someone, like, if I tangibly help someone become, the musician they want to be, it would be so much more fulfilling than, like, playing to the live stream and then signing off. And I don't know what I'm going to get out of that or what else other people are going to get out of that.
Well, I can't speak for anybody else, but I watched the show that you did at Georgia Tech, and it was transcendent. For a moment, I was outside of it. For a moment, I could let it all go and just, you know, be there. And it was fun. I really enjoyed it. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that felt that way. So
that is beautiful feedback, and I really do appreciate it.
It's been great talking to you, and
lovely to talk to you too.
Give the little ones a hug for me, and
it's
been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure as well. All right.
Thanks so much. Keke King's new album is called Modern Yesterdays. From it, this is a tune called Say Say. This is Scenic Roots on listener-supported public radio.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.